This is KMJR Radio.
Your sacred, sincere, and dedicated
Desert Radio.
Become veteran of
Ghost Radio.
There you go again. On your own again. Somebody else gonna find you out. Don't go whining. Oh, be tamed, you're pining. 'Cause nobody cares anymore. Every time you talk, you dig a deeper grave. And the walls come slowly crumbling in. It's no use squirming. This time you're learning that what you've given, you're gonna get right back. Every time you step on another friend, as you climb your golden stair, at the top you find all those souls you've left behind. But the ones you're gonna meet on your way back down. There you are again, the same old scene again. Some other fool playing the lead. Round and round again, the same old story goes again. And you can never leave your carousel. There you go again, on your own again. Somebody else done found you out. Don't go whining or pretend you're pining. 'Cause nobody cares anymore. Every time you talk, you dig a deep grave. And the walls come slowly crumbling in. It's no use squirming. This time you're learning that what you've given to people, you're gonna get right back. Sometimes twice. Every time you step upon another friend, as you climb the golden stair, at the top you find all those souls you've left behind. All the ones you're gonna meet on your way back down. Here you are again, the same old scene again, with some other fool playing in the lead. Round and round again, the same old story goes again. And you can never leave your carousel. There you go again, on your own again. Somebody else done found you out. Don't go whining. Or pretend you're pining. 'Cause nobody here gives a flying f*** anymore. Every time you talk, you dig a deeper grave. And the walls come slowly crumbling in. It's no use squirming. This time you've been learning that what you've given, you're gonna get right back. Sometimes twice. Here you are again, the same old scene again, with some other fool playing in the round and round. old again. The same old story goes again. And you can never leave your carousel.
Well, good evening and welcome to Ghost Radio. And tonight we have a special guest. We're talking to Mr. Alan Graham, author of the new book, I Remember Jim Morrison. He's going to be chatting with us and elaborating on some of the content of this cool new book. And it's great having you with us, Alan.
My pleasure, young Scott.
We look through this book and we see a wide variety of things that are really never mentioned in any of the other Morrison biographies, things that either one might think slipped through the cracks or just weren't sensational, ridiculous, or, you know, what we would say meeting the agenda of the writer in order to promote whatever point of view they had about Jim and his life. Would you agree that's pretty close?
I do. And in fact, I got a review from my sister in Liverpool today, and she pretty much summed up how it's been, let's just say, this past 30-something years, what the image has been, what's been built, what's been created, manufactured, and all of that. And she summed it up like this. When my brother... I called my brother in America, and each new book that came out about Jim Morrison, it seemed like it was the same old stuff, and it was more and more sensational, and then it seemed like lies. And my brother would always tell me, no one ever spoke from inside the Morrison family, so all you know about Jim Morrison is those five sensational years of his life in the public eye. However, one day, when the time is right, I will write a book and tell it all. And then she said, well, lo and behold, he finally did. And it's nothing like anything I ever read in any of those books. So even my sister in England, you know, understood immediately the real Jim Morrison. And that's what comes out in this book.
She said that she often would ask you upon reading subsequent Morrison books or posthumous Morrison books, whether this was true or that was true, whether such an event took place or such a speculation was accurate. And if I recall, your response was, in general, what you saw were lots of, let's call them, fabrications.
Yeah, it was not the man, it was the myth. And the myth has reigned with a vengeance for the past 30-something years, because everyone involved, all of the people involved, except the direct people who knew Jim Morrison, which was us. No one in the family ever spoke out except for a word or two to the press, not much. But no one ever discussed the inner workings of Jim's family or how he became. No one knew, really. They always thought Morrison was a biker or a Manson type or a street type or a low class, you know, working class, blue collar. No, sir. They never knew, because the Admiral would never allow anyone. It was just a matter of dignity. Jim Morrison even said it better in the end. He said, I think you'll remember this one, Mr. Mojo. It was something about journalists interviewing worms inside coffins. Remember that?
Yeah, leading to the idea that any kind of thing like that was all part of the mask created for social purposes.
Just
which,
like,
I mean, well, obviously, if you're going to be involved in that kind of... business and industry, their specialty is creating masks. I think what we see oftentimes, too, whether we're reading your book or, you know, I think you can read between the lines in the other books, and you can see that I really don't believe that it would be possible for Morrison to sit still and allow himself to be portrayed or shaped according to a kind of a media paradigm in which he would be expected to live up to certain things or behave in certain ways or have a kind of a public relations image, preferring instead to be himself to the greatest extent possible. Would that be accurate, or is there more to it than that?
It once again, it changes over time because the myth built up so much that you really don't know the substance. Even now that I'm writing about it, there's such a legend to come up against, such a myth to come up against that people, for example, one interviewer told me one time, oh, didn't he swell to 350 pounds and was found dead in the bathroom? No, sweetie, that was Elvis. Oh, wasn't he 6'4"? No, he had boots on that made him look bigger. And then you've got people on the, you know, the message boards and the chat rooms. They create the myth even more of like swearing to God that Jim was this and that. And it's like you'll come up against this wall of non-reason where people will never believe other than they've believed all these years because it's so powerful. The myth is so powerful, and people want to believe the myth more than anything else. But the lost opportunity was on the family side, because while they remained dignified and above it all, a lot of, let's say, chicanery went on behind the scenes with Morrison's myth and his image and his life. And in one sense, I say, you know, he would have loved it all, because all of the loonies out there, all of the Jim Morrison fakes, sons, daughters, people pretending to be him still alive. Even Ray Manzarek encourages that kind of thing, pretending that he was writing a book with this guy who was claiming to be Jim Morrison. He lived down in the Virgin Islands, and he didn't know if it was or not, but he wasn't sure. And it's like, even, you know, what historians forget is this. Unless you were there, right there, now that's one compliment Albert Goldman did give me once. He said, there's always been somebody like you right there to really record the true history, not from the historian who gets the data, who researches the data. He doesn't know. The historian knows and often makes it out to be the way he sees it. And this is the big difference between history and myth. And myth is more powerful than history, isn't it?
It's because it's so difficult to look at Jim and look at him as you've portrayed him in your book, and look at him as 40 other books have portrayed him, and see that there's the rock god and the sex god and the romantic figure and these numerous personalities that every single book seems to create under the guise of revealing the true Jim, whereas yours seems to be taken from a shoulder-to-shoulder point of view.
Well, let me just say this. 30 years ago, I produced Morrison the Rock Opera, and in that rock opera, I cast 7 Jim Morrisons, all as aspects of this guy, this myriad personality, and that's what he was. He was mercurial, and he was like mercury in your hands. He could be this for him, that for her, this for you, that for me. This is the magic of versatile character.
Chameleon-like.
But, yeah, so we call them the Jimtations, for a joke, like the Temptations, you know. But every one of those characters was different, a different person, of course. And even though they were all dressed like Jim Morrison, their own personalities were so strong because they were all attempting to get the spotlight and fighting each other, literally, physically. And then, but it showed that was Morrison. He could have been any one of those characters. He really could, and he was. That was the weird thing about it, that he was many, we call it legions of ghosts that hung around him. I literally referred to it as the formaldehyde ghost that spoke with him, that hung with him, and that hung with all of these famous other great luminaries and people who drank a lot, like John Barrymore. And there was this constant companion, this ghost that hung with you and lived with you and slept with you and ate with you and died with you too. And so Morrison was really also part myth. He truly was part myth that he created, and he made sure that people never knew that he was, you know, had a family or that they were alive. It was like when Pamela discovered that, the myth that Morrison was, even to hers, began to crumble before his eyes and everyone else's too, because suddenly he was cast down to the ground as, oh my God, he does have a sister. Oh my God, she does look just like him. Oh my God, that's his nephew in his arms, and oh Christ, he looks like him. And it's like thunderstruck these people were at that all that mask, all that myriad personalities, all those myths, all of the whole thing changed the moment we stepped into the scene. So in a way, we changed Morrison's existence by our very presence.
Then you would say that we have a degree of truth to be found in each of the portrayals, but none of them really give the core of the person that you knew.
And that was deliberate on his part, because we always go back to this, the legend he created by using the lizard. He's always talking, and there was a recording of this once where he said, "Now look, let's remember that the lizard is an arbitrary species, and by that I mean that if all the lizards on the earth disappeared tomorrow, it wouldn't make a bit of difference because they exist outside of the food chain," which means it is projecting, saying, "I am this lizard. I don't live with you all. I've dropped out of that society. I've created this new persona, this visage of some middle-class Clark Kent kid suddenly turned into Superman. Godlike, Grecian features, Adonis, totally perfectly athletic, and very, very, very intelligent. All of a sudden, out of a middle-class kid comes this bump, and that's his own doing, his own hand, and that's the, and then until that got out of control, it was like he was the man to himself and to everybody around him. They look at him, couldn't even look him in the eye. He was that highly intelligent. He could stare you down. He could also lift your head up like a Svengali or a Rasputin, and this is no joke. He would lift your head up and put it on the ceiling in 1 minute and put it on the floor the next minute. So he was, in a way, Rasputin-esque. He had this incredible power over people, mostly because the way he looked, and mostly because he just believed that he could do it. And he did it.
And we see that as part of the content of numerous books, that he could be who the person who he was engaged with at the moment
absolutely
wanted him to be. Therefore, he was fascinating to everyone who encountered him.
Yes.
At the same time, reading between the lines of I Remember by Al Graham, one gets the general idea that in terms of family, they didn't buy into that.
Who didn't buy into it? I'm not sure what you meant by that.
Anna and Andy.
They didn't
they
buy into
knew him all his life, and therefore his many myriad persona, his great ability to be what others wanted him to be, had very little effect on his most intimate loved ones, and they would often take him to task.
We would mock him. Yeah.
I don't know if they thought of it as pretensions or not.
No. See, the thing about it is, everybody adored him. All of us adored him, and we all loved that image. But we, unlike most people, knew that was the image, because they knew, and for a year before I'd met him, all they did was talk about this missing brother, and it was like I kind of knew him, and then when I got to know him, I knew him, but we never knew him as the Lizard King. We always laughed behind the scenes with him, because he was laughing too, that he pulled it off. You know, it was like, don't forget, he was a little chubby middle-class kid, Navy brat, that not unlike 99% of the others, no different, out of the same mold, wore the same clean-cut haircut, the same loafers, the same expensive, you know, upper-class kid clothes. And it's like, boy, that was the Jim Morrison, the real Jim Morrison. So we would often have a chance to sit down to him, like his sister would say to him, what is this thing about Remember When We Were in Africa? What's that? What did you put that on the end of a song? We were all laughing, and he'd just jokingly laugh back. He'd say, oh, you know what? I was in Hawaii. You know, you read that in the book where the little girl was running around.
Oh, yeah.
Wild. And, you know, that's where Wild Child came from, that inspiration for Wild Child. This was Wild Child on the beach. Well, and so she said, well, what's that got to do with Africa? And he said, I just threw it in.
So he kept a sense of irony, you would say, about his life. And anyone who's read even a few Morrison interviews knows that he often said, in his own words, that a lot of that was tongue-in-cheek to begin with.
Absolutely. In fact, when he was in his school play, a local journalist interviewed him after the school play because he was so good, and asked him what his name was, and he said Stanislas Boleslavsky, and they printed it in the college paper, Stanislas Boleslavsky. So even
and they printed it.
Yeah.
So he was, what was the term you used in his book? He was putting on the agony.
Yeah, putting on the agony, putting on the style. There was a song in the 40s or the 50s, and it was, well, you could tell it was about the 20s. It was probably regurgitated in the 50s, but it went something like this. Young man in a hot rod car, driving like he's mad, with a pair of yellow gloves he borrowed from his dad. He makes it roar so loudly just to see his girlfriend smile. But we know he's only putting on the style. Ooh, putting on the agony, putting on the style. That's what all the young folks are doing all the while. And as I look around me, I sometimes had to smile, seeing all the young folk putting on the style. And that was a song that Morrison was just putting on the agony, putting on the style.
And, of course, people want that, and it's all part of the popular culture. I suppose that, you know, also relates to the number of red windbreakers sold after James Dean played The Rebel Without a Cause.
Well, you've never seen anybody's bones jumped on so much as Jim Morrison's bones. And before the Doors estate, my family, the Admiral and my ex-wife Anna and my son Dylan, finally put the clamp down and got it organized, that all these bootleggers were now, you know, unnoticed to cut it out, and all of this other memorabilia that was being sold in the billions and has been and still has in the underground market, all kinds of bootlegging going on all over Morrison's name. The estate got precious little from it until in the last decade.
And then, of course, there's what you get with the Morrison that has been subsequently manufactured, which is like a snapshot lost in time of a nostalgic yet revolutionary moment.
Yeah, well, speaking of revolutionary moments, if you'll remember in the book when Morrison and I, we rode into Santa Monica and we sat on the off-ramp, we were coming off the off-ramp, and you looked down over the city of Santa Monica, and it looked white, like a gleaming city.
Yeah, I can really see that beautiful, clear afternoon.
Cobalt blue sky and a beautiful, warm afternoon. Morrison sitting right next to me in that giant sheepskin World War II bomber's jacket. And he's musing about life and how exciting and how... And he would come over the hill like this and he looked down and he said, "This is where it's all going to start, right here. This is where the revolution is going to start, right here, right here." And he was so full of, like, belief. And this wasn't hopeful belief. This was a sense of, like, how do I say? His resolve was strong. It was almost like, it's around the corner. It's going to happen. So later on, at dinner, with a lot of friends sitting around, and I asked him quietly, "Exactly what did you mean by revolution here, you see? Well, something going on that I don't know?" or are you just saying, they say you want a revolution? No, he sat seriously and said, "Oh, no, Lou, don't let me mislead you. When I said revolution, I'm talking about all artisans, all of the young people who have crafts and skills. We started all over again. We get out of the system. We make things of our own. We create jewelry and tables and lamps and all the things that we buy from this machine over here, and we start our own economy." And it was like he was profoundly saying, gently change the system. Just don't go into this consume. And like, it was way ahead of his time, but he was right on about the revolution being a gentle revolution, being a wise revolution, which inevitably it turned out to be, because his revolution was, well, you know, you see, he described himself as an erotic politician. That's a profound statement. And even though Anna and I laughed at it, and he laughed at it, he really meant that. We were laughing at, yeah, he really is. He's, well, there's a contradiction there. There's Jim saying, revolution. There's the Admiral saying, oh, no, no, no. There's the society saying, oh, no, if we have a revolution, it means guns in the street. And Morrison didn't mean that, but he sure as hell shook the cage because he also realized that there's no such thing as a gentle revolution and that you have to shake it up. The weather underground, people went too far, but you have to get loud and noisy for anything really to happen. And it wasn't until the 60s that we even really addressed racism in the world, in the country.
Indeed, that's so.
It was an incredible upheaval, but it had to happen, and it did happen, and it's still going on, but it's a lot better than it was.
Suppose Jim read a number of the books that have been written about him in the past.
This is what one of these times I get, unadulterated, not on commercial radio when you're always getting interrupted by commercials. I wanted to always say this, and I do as often as I can. No one here gets out alive is the false Bible. It is actually two books. The first one was written by Jerry Hopkins, who wrote the biography of Elvis, a well-known established writer. And he wrote this book, and he got it all ready, and he shopped every publisher, and every single publisher, small and large alike, told him the following. It is boring. It is depressing. What the... Don't you have any stories from his brother? Yeah, I got a couple. There's his brother.
And you have to remember about that time, if I may interrupt here, the Doors were dead.
Oh, yeah.
Dead.
Oh, yeah. Dead. That's right. That's a good point.
Two post-Morrison albums and silence.
Yeah. Well, the next thing is that's the convergence of the Doors and this book, because this book lay dormant in Jerry Hopkins' hands, and he couldn't even get arrested with it, right? So I don't know how this alliance occurred, but they got this Sugarman kid, and Manzarek was fronted him, you know, says, Danny Sugarman, he was there, he knows the whole story, so he'll write his book with me. Well, Danny wrote his book, which was not written by Danny at all, written by hack writers that he hired and fought with, and anyway, he got all of this collection of this crap together with all of these different hands on it, and Ray in the background telling all of this made up not verified. You would have to have been a fly on the wall to discover what went on inside a room with Jim and this girl, because that's the way they told it, like they were there. Right, well, remember, it's two books, and Jerry Hopkins was hopping mad because they put his stories with theirs, and he knew full well that it was a lot of crap. Because
he was a journalist. He'd done his
research. Right, right. He was a professional. And these were amateur butcher bastards who knew nothing about it. Suddenly, Danny Sugarman's a famous guy. So this book is this combination of two books. One is total trash. The other one is boring and depressing. And the reason it's like that is because no one ever really fully blossomed, fleshed out this character. All you have is like, if you took any one of our lives for 7 years and said, that's what he was, well, and then he died, well, that's what we would be. But there was a whole bunch more before that. So the myth has been perpetrated essentially by this false Bible of no one here gets out alive. They even had the balls to take a public record picture of the Admiral in his full Admiral's outfit and put it in the front page and claim an unauthorized biography. And there's nothing the Admiral could do about that picture because it's public record. It belongs to the public. His picture belongs to the public. But they sure as hell tried to give it some credibility. However, once you get past the first page, you realize, if you've been anywhere near Morrison, Lysiandro and all the other people who knew Morrison will tell you precisely what I say. It is pure fiction. It is absolute fiction. And in the worst sense, you can tell that it's a lie because it shows nothing about the Morrison in my book. That's, for example, you can just read about the gentle part of Morrison that you've never even heard of in that book. You don't know anything about it. You don't know where his childhood was, what made him like he was. And that's the bad part of that book, is it spawned all these other books. And by the way, 40 books that was a year ago count. Since then, I think it's even more than 100.
Well, a lot of the other books, if you think about it, a lot of the other books were, their audience was at least probably half people who were not before the reading of those other books, Doors fans.
Real
Doors fans who were there and who grew up in those times probably had a different take on it than that. And in the case of I Remember by Alan Graham, we see a particular set of circumstances reflecting the times, the culture, the people involved, and our protagonist, Jim Morrison, that's very real, gives rather a bit of the same impression one had of who Morrison might be, just as a stranger, as a celebrity, that one could have easily had during the time period in which he was alive, as opposed to this created post-mortem image of Morrison that has brought about the whole new generation of Doors fans.
One day we were in Griffith Park. There was Hannah and I and Dylan and Jim and Pamela. And I think, I don't know who else, there were a couple other hangers-on, that's what they were. And Jim was showing us his Los Angeles. And we went up to Griffith Park, and Pamela was saying, look at that, the valley's grown. Oh, in the last 5 years, it's grown all the way out there. So what we were looking at 40 years ago was brand-new housing in this valley that's now 40 years later. But it was all orange groves before that, you know. And so Morrison's there showing us, so proudly showing us the statue and where James Dean shot that movie, and up on the roof and the balcony, and just really, he loved Americana, and he loved the things of America that were great, let's put it that way. Anyway, so we're walking out, and this guy comes over out of nowhere and says, hey, Jim, Jim! And Morrison turns around, it's a guy, a hippie, and he says, man, good to see you. And this guy said, hey, Joe, good to see you. Where you been? I've been down here and here. Hey, man, love your album. By the way, man, thanks a lot for saving my life. And we all went, what? Well, apparently Morrison, when he lived in Venice, was a kind of a Fagin kind of guy. You know, he lived on a roof. There's nowhere to live. Parents stopped sending him money. And he kind of was the older guy, intelligent, graduated. So he kind of had a little gang, you know, of street kids that, you know, sometimes he could sleep in their house and sometimes, but he was older than them. So he kind of led this gang around, you know, and they sometimes people got mugged, let's put it that way. So he wasn't a thug by any means, but he hung with these kids. They all smoked pot, and he was on the street, and it was like they found places to eat, and he was kind of like their leader, you know what I mean? So this guy said that one night, this Morrison was leading this gang down the street outside this liquor store, and he came out after just buying something, and they all surrounded him. They were going to take his money, and they were going to f*** him up if he didn't give it. And Morrison looked at him and said, nah, I went to school with that guy. Let him go. And he let him go. So that's another glimpse of Morrison as the real man on the street. Direct. You know, I'm observing this, standing there watching this, and Jim's sister and I were looking at, wow, that's Jim. That's where you were on that roof. That's what you were doing. And so we get these marvelous glimpses into his life, historically accurate. That's a jewel, you know. That was a jewel to me to hear that story, and I heard so many more like that about him after his death, you know.
You have to also take into account that Morrison's intentions, as he often stated, were to inspire people, and you must say he certainly is still doing so 40 years later.
Well, he also enticed people and incited people, and he did some certainly dangerous things when he was drunk. He never did it when he was sober, and I'll tell you why. There are two people who existed inside Jim Morrison, and one was that little schoolboy, wooden, butter wouldn't melt in his mouth, innocent, beautiful, sad eyes from the rowdy night before, that when you looked at him, you could hardly yell at him. It was a different person because it wasn't that person. It was Jekyll. It wasn't Hyde or whatever there. It was that thing about when you drink too much and you go into this bad place, it's so terrible that you go into this terrible remorse and you act like a young child who, I've seen it so many times, and every celebrated drinker goes through this little game Well, you couldn't possibly yell at them the next day because they look so innocent. And after all, that bad drunk's gone now. It's them, and that's the reality. And Morrison knew that, and it was like what I call false remorse or temporary remorse. It's like, I'll never do that again. I feel so bad. But the next night, you're doing the same thing. So he lived between these personalities, too, and this is a very interesting part of all people who drink too much. They forget who they were because they were not that person. They might know instinctively that what they did, but they really are not that same person the next day. So they're kind of like, well, yeah.
And they're looking for empathy again.
Absolutely.
And, of course, if you're in circumstances where you're intimate with people, you know them personally, and you're communicating with them directly, and you have that charm, that empathy comes out. But in terms of the media, in terms of newspapers, magazines, the world of popular opinion, it's much more difficult to pull that off.
Yeah, very uncool to be in rehab back then, because it's like, dude, you can't handle it? You can't chug a lug with all of us? God, there was a drinking game, a sickening drinking game in most bars, and it was chug-a-lug. And if you couldn't handle chugging a beer, and then they'd sit down, and there were 10 people sitting around, and if you couldn't handle it, you were a lightweight. And a lot of people became, you know, like terribly addicted to alcohol because of this game that people played.
It's all part of the culture and the atmosphere and the prevailing attitude of those times. And in a lot of ways, we see that reflected in I Remember, and that's what makes it such a distinctive book from the rest of the biographical jotting scribblings and screeds about Jim Morrison.
Well, this might sound egocentric, but I love to read my book in the morning when no one's around, you know, and it's having a cup of coffee and rereading and things. I'm saying to myself, oh, God, now I started this chapter, and I've now right next to me I've got like 600 pages more just of that chapter, and I'm saying, okay, what am I going to do today? So the reading the book inspires me to write more and more and more. And when I read the stories over and over again, I remember other things that I would have forgotten, perhaps, well, maybe not. But the point is, in this conversation, this is the way I had it with the Morrisons, you could talk about Jim's life. You could ask them, what was Jim like back then, and did he do that? And so I'm telling stories to the Admiral about what Jim did to me, and he said, oh, no, wait a minute. What? Did he tell you that? Because let me tell you this other story. And it was the mortuary story. And so he got that from me, or he played that same prank. Ah, and he was proud of the
And so he did get transmission of culture,
yes,
from his own old man.
Yes, he did get transmission of culture. And that's a wonderful phrase, by the way. Isn't that a Native American terminology?
Well, it's generally speaking just a way of looking at it from the point of view of a society that values the truth and honesty and the future. So you get that from Native American people, from Aboriginal peoples, and
yeah,
it becomes more and more of a the more anthropologists and other scientists realize the importance of looking at history and at the truth that you have from your own life, how necessary it is to convey those ideas and thoughts to the coming generations. Which,
yeah,
is another thing, by the way, about your book, is that when you read I Remember, I think one of the things that also makes it unique is that your personal viewpoint is shared throughout the book. And being the author, you are also revealing things about yourself, and it makes it a much more interesting read, and I might add, like your brother was saying, one that you can sit down and read more than once, read over and over again, because you're getting not just a historical or intellectual outline, but you're getting a kind of an emotional thread that carries you through it and gives you something of a perceptual experience of what it was like to know the man and what it was like to live in those times. I think that's one of the most unique and important things about I Remember Jim Morrison.
Well, there's several books in my life that I've read that have made a profound impression on me, and they're all about sociology. They're all about the times and the life and times of people. And one of my most favorite books was a book called Through a Distant Mirror, and it's by Barbara W. Tuchman, a wonderful, wonderful historian. And she writes about the time of the, I think, 13th and 14th century, and it's literally about the De Coucy family, just about a family, rich family, and it describes every single aspect of their daily life, from the food and the bad stomach ache they got from the overspoiled food, and just with such intricacy that you could never not read it over and over and over again. And one day I noticed that my Ariel, my little girl, had this book, and she loved it. And she said, "It's my book, Daddy, it's my book." And she kept it, and she kept it, and she walked around. And it was the beautiful, you know, wood carvings of Elizabethan and beautiful tapestry and all that. So she loved the art of it. But she kept that book. And because of her, I kept that book. And I just looked at it the other day, and still there. It's the most incredibly descriptive book, and it's like, just to be even remotely connected with any kind of that kind of, you know, recording of history, which is what happened to me, you know, as I say, standing by watching the Admiral in his angst, in his anger, in his sadness, in his like stoicness, in his intractability, in all of his moods, and all of the Clara's moods, and all of the Morrison family's moods, all of the reactions on Andy and on me and on Anna and after Jim's death, and all of the things that the world out there saw it one way. We lived a whole different view of it, and nobody recorded that except I did. In every single way, in every breath of my life, in the past 40 years, I am a walking, talking vault of Morrison history, and that no one has that view of it. And it's like I hold a very, very sacred position. And if I was any lesser of a person, and I mean that, it's so easy to get tempted by someone like Goldman, who promises you gold just for the dirt, and that's all he ever wrote, dirt, because the truth is, dirt sells quicker than anything else. Dirty gossip, lies, malicious innuendo. Now, that's the public I'm talking about, but there's a solid base of Morrison fans all over this globe, as my sister says, and behind them, a solid, you know, base of real honest people who know the real truth and not who do not like American Idol, let's put it that way, except as a joke, you know, but the whole serious part of the world, and I mean the world, English-speaking or not, Mexico is another big thing for us, because I remember translated into Spanish, because Morrison had a wonderful following down there. So this is the wonderful place to be, to really, you know, like I feel after all these years, I finally feel vindicated, because everyone I know thought I was going to write a dirty inside tell-it-all book, because after all, for the last, you know, 20 years, the Morrisons and I and the family have been at odds over the
portrayal. And I suppose now that all those have been written, now was indeed the proper time for you to come out with yours.
Yes, it was, and it is, isn't it?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been speaking to Alan Graham this evening and talking about his new book, I Remember Jim Morrison, which is available in numerous places on Amazon.com, at DarkWriters.com, and at TheGhostRadioNetwork.com.
And LizardKingLounge.com.
LizardKingLounge.com. So the book has just been released. Word is just now getting out about it. And it's time to investigate it further if you're interested in the sort of things we've been discussing in this interview with Alan Graham. And, Alan, it's been a pleasure.
Man, I swear to God, that was a wonderful conversation we had. It wasn't an interview. And that's the other thing I was going to tell you. I don't do interviews because they're just boring, and especially when you get on commercial television and they say, well, we'll be right back, and then you have 4 miles of colon commercials or, you know, erectile dysfunction ads or cat food ads. And when you come back, you're like, it's like the Russian army just walked through your mouth, that kind of a taste. You don't want
to
do it.
Well, the idea is to get a train of thought, we would hope.
Yeah, like
and
we had.
Able to hold on to it.
We had wonderful time, and we were able to expound and give more, you know, a better view of Jim, and that's the way I'm doing it from now on. So just like this in podcasts.
Well, and let's do it again. Let's do it again fairly soon.
All right, I'll come over to your house.
I know we've got. Oh my God, we've got 2 or 3 more hours worth of talking about it. We could do.
Yeah, that
and
everything. That and everything else. I want to give a plug here for the American Cancer Society. All you boys out there, you got a sister, you got a daughter, you got a girlfriend, they've got sisters. The women in this world are numerous. They're more than us boys, but they're also under attack from that bastard called cancer. And if you can drop $5, just don't think about big donations. The real donations come from ordinary people doing $5 and $10 all day long. Now, do me a favor. Instead of putting your nose on some of that Drano and having a face like Quasimodo, put the money in your local charity for women's breast cancer or for infants with cancer. Come on, you bastards, give. People tell me, look, if you want people to give, you've got to treat them nice and you've got to baby them. F off. Give till you can't give no more and do something that will make you feel good, because I want to tell you the honest truth, listeners. Whenever I work with a terminally ill person, which I am just recently, every single one of them is more brave than I could ever be. When I get a pain in the back or a pain in the ass, I whine like a goat. Wait a minute, goats don't whine. Whoever whines, that's the way I whine. These people are brave. They're facing incredible odds, and they're brave. So do me a favor and do yourself a favor. If you want to feel really good about yourself, put some money into a worthwhile charity that you know is going to be, you know, I'm saying breast cancer, but I mean all kind of cancer.
So admit the American Cancer Society is good, huh?
I do. And we've got an ad up on our ghostradionetwork.com, and it's a little girl called Teresa Ogle who is suffering a rare cancer, and she's such a hero. And then we've got my godmother, the godmother of my children, Cheryl Scow, the American Cancer Society in Durango, Colorado, is one of the bravest women on this earth, and she also raises an awful lot of money for these causes. So if you're ever in Durango, go over to her house, take a beer out of the refrigerator, put that cowboy hat on that she keeps there, and tell her that I'll send you, and you've got $100 for her. Or don't even go there, okay?
And send $5.
Yeah, you can send $5. It's been really cool, man. I love
that's
these kind of interviews.
Pal. That's really great of you, pal.
Yeah.
We'll do it again soon.
All right, brother. Rock on, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, moving on to the next series of things here at Ghost Radio. We'll be coming up with some more music and some more interesting tales, discussions, poetry, noise, and other things that aren't so easily explained. Thank you for listening.
If you wake up in a cold gray dawn, and the birds don't sing, there's a coming storm. If you lift your head and it's full of pain, and you've been caught in a tinsel rain, tinsel rain. It's falling down. Sometimes it's cold like her hands. Tinsel rain can make you cry, break your heart, and make love die. Nothing seems real since she's been gone. Miles of dreams are rinsed away. Nothing to say since the silence came. Better stay away from that tinsel rain. 'Cause tinsel rain, it's falling down. Sometimes it's cold, just like
Love Day.